All right, welcome everyone. This is Jeffrey Lin here with another episode of Shut Up and Dribble. For my guest today, I have my friend Kevin Tian. Kevin, do you want to introduce some more about yourself?
Yeah, sure. Hi, I'm Kevin. I actually went to Georgetown with Jeffrey, and you know, we're back in the Bay Area together, so that's really nice.
So I brought Kevin on today to kind of explore the question of fandom and what that really means. So Kevin is a big Boston sports fan, and I think they are notoriously to be diehard fans, and I just don't know, I honestly don't know why, that everyone I've met from Boston is like a huge sports fan, like, of the team, and that's not, like, I'm from Atlanta, and it's entirely the opposite there. I think probably something that has to do with, like, the win record of Atlanta versus Boston. So yeah, Kevin, could you tell me a little bit about like how you've like developed your fandom and where it like really stemmed from?
Man, yeah, that's a good question, because that really takes me back memory lane in terms of when I first started getting into sports. I think I first started getting into Boston sports around middle of elementary school. I was totally out of the loop when it came to Boston sports, you know, immigrant family. My parents were certainly not connected to American sports culture. But during elementary school, I remember how excited people were when the Patriots would win the Super Bowl. And, you know, basically like you would see those big headlines, all those pictures in the Boston Globe. Teachers would paste clippings from the newspaper onto different boards and things like that. And we actually did subscribe to the Boston Globe. And so that was always just like very eye-catching, because you would see all the like pretty blue colors of the Patriots uniforms, you know, the big 2001 Super Bowl win, and then you start seeing it again 2003, 2004, and then of course you have the big Red Sox comeback at 2004. Just like the culmination of all those moments and like basically all the people around you celebrating it gets you intrigued about like, okay, what's this, what's going on? Mm-hmm. Basically middle elementary school, I started watching the Patriots, I started watching the Red Sox, the Celtics less. I think I wasn't as into basketball yet, maybe partially due to win record and just, you know, the exposure of big Super Bowl wins, big World Series wins from the people around me. But basically I started watching some of the games, and you know, as you start watching it and you know, you start talking about it with friends, it just becomes like a ritual. It's just like something that you know, you can look forward to. It's like, oh, the Patriots game is on this Sunday, and that just became part of routine. I think also for me, I'm a big like numbers guy, or I, you know, as a kid, I always loved looking into like box scores and things like that too, and so sports definitely fed that passion as well. I think it's just like the combination of these factors, right? The cultural element of being around it, and then just like the intellectual intrigue and just like having that ritual. I think those three things is like what got it started for me.
Got it. No, that makes a lot of sense. So, Kevin, I have a question for you. Do you remember 9/11 more or the 2001 Super Bowl that the Patriots won?
Okay, well, definitely 9/11. And the reason
why
it's like...
Are you sure? It's okay. It's okay if it's not 9/11.
No, it's definitely 9/11. The reason why is because I wasn't quite a Patriots fan yet, right? Like, I think it was... Uh-huh. It was after the fact, seeing like hearing about it through the people around me, because otherwise, you know, like again, immigrant family, my family would have never exposed me to it otherwise before.
Yeah. So, like about that, is it growing up? So did you grow up in Boston? I assume you grew up in Boston. I actually never asked this.
Yeah. Well, a suburb, right? I uh-huh. I didn't grow up directly in the city. Okay. But shout out to Chelmsford. That's where I grew up originally. And then I moved to Acton, Massachusetts in eighth grade, so like right before high school.
Got it. Okay. So growing up, were there like a lot of other like Asian Americans like around where you lived? Were you kind of like one of the few?
That's a good question. So in Chelmsford, I was one of the few, and I didn't even like think about it or realize it. Like I just didn't think about race too much, I think, as an elementary school kid. Yeah. But I started noticing it more though once I moved to Acton. In Acton, I think there were a lot more Asian Americans around me, just in my classes and things like that. And that's what made me more conscious and like aware, like, oh wow, like I didn't even realize like I was this minority before. So that was definitely interesting looking back.
So was the Boston sports, did it kind of like, you know, did it transcend race, I guess is my question. Did it feel like, was that something like, you know, everyone kind of like coalesced over regardless of like the race you were?
I think so. Yeah. Like, cause yeah, I didn't even think about my race at all, in relation to Boston sports or anything like that. It was just like, this is an exciting event that happens that like everyone talks about at school and everyone gets excited about. And so that's all it was to me as an elementary school kid.
That seems to be like kind of like my experience too, just like whenever, you know, sports is always like a good thing to like fall back on. Like if I, like, you know, if I'm in the Uber, right, with someone and I just don't know, like I don't know this person at all, but we can talk about like the same like sports team, especially around here, just like I'll just like talk about the Warriors or something, and it's something like, you know, we can like all connect on. Why do you think Boston has such a reputation for being a diehard kind of like sports town? Do you think it's just because like the historical success and everything? Because I can think of like a couple other, well, maybe San Francisco is probably a little bit more recent, but I don't think I've ever met an obnoxious San Francisco sports fan.
Yeah. I think it's a combination of the historical success for sure. Just like, you know, just how people will rally around, you know, like the U.S. even, or their company, whatever. Just that feeling of like, you know, we've won, we've done it well. I think the historical success is definitely one component. I think the other component is just the level of emotional investment the community has in it. And so SF, I mean, I recognize that like my exposure to SF has mostly been through people in my peer network, which is, you know, a lot of people who have been transplants to SF, right? So not necessarily a lot of like SF born and raised people in my peer group that I regularly interact with. But I think that may be a factor, right? Like the fact that like the people that we hang out with, a lot of them are transplants from Georgetown University or, you know, some other part of the East Coast. And SF, you know, in the workplaces that we're at as well, just like we have a lot of transplants. We don't necessarily have, you know, a lot of like diehard fans who are born and raised here, maybe multi-generations that like I had exposure to coming from Massachusetts. So I think that might be part of it. And then, yeah, I think it's just like because of the long history of, you know, the Red Sox, the Patriots, the Celtics, I think like, yeah, just it's just a multi-generational thing now in Boston. And so like, you know, parents are excited about it, grandparents are excited about it. And so you get that in the Boston area as well.
Got it. Do you feel like Bill Simmons had an effect on that? Because I, you know, kind of one of the most obnoxious like writers out there and one of the most successful is became like so prolific. Did you like follow him?
I actually don't follow him that much actively. Like I know who he is. I don't follow him that much actively, but I do think like, yeah, those sorts of personalities, and like there's like a Boston personality too, right? Like I think like Bill Burr as well, for example. I think those personalities just like feed this virtual loop of like what it means to be a Bostonian and the culture and you know, and the emphasis on Boston sports. So I do think like people like him have an impact on the city.
Right. Yeah, that makes sense. Okay. You know, I think a big reason why I wanted you to have you on today just is to discuss kind of what part of it's like, I think nowadays where fandom can get complicated, right? Because now with the news cycle and, you know, everyone's history is just out there. I think, you know, it was Boston, not really the Celtics, but I think Boston in general, okay, only the Patriots have had kind of like their own like history of issues. And I think what brought this on was the recent report by ESPN from Baxter Holmes about the allegations of racism and like sexual misconduct and employee like harassment by the owner of the Phoenix Suns, Robert Sarver. And I think this, to me, this brings up this question of how loyal am I like supposed to be to a team, and to what extent is a team represented by their players, by their coach, by their owner? Because I don't know if, and I think it varies by team, I don't know if you think of the Celtics, for example, and think of their owners, because I have no idea who they are. But I think if you think about like the Mavericks, most people can answer, oh, it's Mark Cuban, right? He's like a big personality in his own right. So I'm, you know, I kind of wonder, where do you kind of see yourself as aligning more with the players, like the coach or the owners, or maybe even the executive when you think of the team, or is it kind of like a mix of all of those?
Yeah, when I think of the team, I mean, I think it's really just more the abstract notion of the team rather than like purely the players or the coaches or the owners or execs. If I had to pick, you know, among those, I would say it's the players that like represent, you know, they're truly the faces of the team, and they're the ones who are out there competing every day. But at the same time, you know, players get traded and or, you know, leave through free agency, or, you know, maybe get suspended due to some major legal issues, etc. And so I think there's still like, is that just abstract concept of a team, and that's number one, at least for me as a fan.
Yeah, I guess for me, like, I don't even, it is tough because when I think about it, I think it is kind of like this more abstract notion of the team. Do you kind of feel like, oh, you're part of some sort of like tribe, right? Like, you're like, I'm from Boston, like, these are like my people and we all root for this one thing.
I think the tribe aspect, there's definitely some of that. But I don't know, I mean, maybe I'm weird in terms of how I think about things, but even like without the tribe, right? Just like, there's this team that has this goal of winning a championship. They represent, you know, yeah, I guess they represent, like you said, this tribe or this group of people, but basically me as a fan, I'm aligning my allegiances with this team. And you know, there's 31 other teams I could align my allegiances to among the NBA. And this is the team that I relate to the most because it's a team that I grew up with and rooted for, even though I now live in a different city than Boston. And so, you know, like, even without the tribe, it's almost just like, you know, it's that thing that you were always rooting for as a kid and you just want to continue to root for. And it's just, it's a symbol, I guess, for like what represents you and like where you came from and things like that.
You know, I think that's right. When I think about like the, a lot of times I've thought about like, I think before growing up, I didn't really like follow the Hawks as well. I think it was probably only because I got into like basketball when I was older. Also, yep, because I had to pick a team. I was like, well, I guess I'll pick Atlanta, right? Because that's where I'm from. And it's funny for me because I feel like I didn't really associate myself with Atlanta until honestly after I developed like an interest in the Hawks. And I think then, yeah, because I think I had to, and I felt like, oh, if I was going to like rep, like it was a rep, like it's the Hawks, I would have to feel like more in tune with the city, right? Oh. Or I guess a little bit, yeah, I had to like find like a connection to that. So I guess it's like some sort of like feedback, right? Like, oh, I like I care about the Hawks, you know, oh, I like care about the city because, you know,
right,
I follow people who like, you know, report on the Hawks and they're also like from the city and they talk about things like from the city more. So it kind of like fed into each other a little bit.
Well, so I have a quick follow up question there. I mean, you said you didn't really relate to Atlanta until you became a Hawks fan. When did you become a Hawks fan? Was this like during college? During high school?
So this was during, this would be during college. So
honestly,
probably their 2015 run when they won like 60 games.
No, I mean, that's interesting to me because I feel like, so you moved from Atlanta to DC to go to college and you didn't necessarily feel like a connection to Atlanta once you moved to DC. That would have been my first guess about when you would have felt that connection, and I guess it wasn't until you got more into the Hawks later on in your college, because 2015, I guess, was your junior year or senior year, junior year.
Yeah.
And so I guess the first couple of years, though, you still didn't necessarily feel that special connection to Atlanta yet. It was really the basketball fandom that brought that forward.
Yeah, I think so, because I didn't, I think a lot of my time in Georgia, I kind of want to get out and go somewhere else.
Right, right.
So I think it wasn't until, like, I found, like, that connection, right?
Okay.
Then I felt like, oh, like, I have, like, a reason to care about this city, which was basketball, which is kind of, I guess, kind of weird. It's kind of, like, the opposite of you, right? You, like, always
right.
grew up in, like, your... Yeah, I guess your connection to the city is, like, sports. Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's fair. I think that's fair.
Yeah. Uh-huh. So, I guess I'm kind of where... So, I don't know about any, like, Celtics, like, owners issues, but I guess when the things... You know, like, Robert Kraft has had yep. legal issues with the massage parlor. When that came down, kind of, like, what's the reaction, like, in your mind? Do you, like... I don't know, like, disown the Patriots or that kind of thing. I mean, also the Patriots, they've been involved in, like, other scandals as well, like Deflategate
right.
and things
right.
like that. Like, what's, like, going on? Like, yeah, what's, like, in real time, like, what's going on in your mind during those times?
Well, I mean, first of all, I think, yeah, they're pretty different moments, right? Like, Deflategate
yeah.
is pretty different than the Robert Kraft scandal. Which is different than Spygate.
Yeah.
And I mean, yeah, we could continue to go down the list. So let's start, I guess, with the Robert Kraft scandal. I mean, that one was very, very disappointing. Like, if I were to give a one word answer, I would say disappointment. It was also, I mean, at least for me, it was just like, yeah, pretty surprising too, like, just to see that happen. Cause I think Robert Kraft had always presented himself as, you know, a family man, or at least, you know, an owner that was everyone liked, both business savvy and understands what it takes to put together a winning team, but also someone the players really connected with and felt was a good guy. Yeah, definitely was just shocked at first, but details came out and you got time to digest it. Yeah, it was just very disappointing. I mean, I think Teddy Bruschi put it pretty well. He was just like, you know, as a, you know, family man and as someone who respects, like, certain values and human, like, you know, human values, it was just extremely disappointing. So yeah, it was a wild time. I don't think I associated that with the team at all. But it certainly looked very poorly, and it was just very poor decision by Robert Kraft. And so yeah, that was a crazy time to be
yeah.
a Patriots fan. And then, you know, we could talk about the other scandals, but I'll let you go first on
no,
the Robert Kraft.
I think it's same. It's clearly disappointing. Were you ever, this might be kind of, like, weird to say,
yeah.
and I think it goes into, like, how, it, no, it's not weird, it's kind of, like, ridiculous to think, you know, because I guess sometimes, like, for me, and I think for you too, like, sports can be such, like, an important part of, like, our lives or, like, our persona. Were you ever
right.
like, because Robert Kraft did this, I will never be a Patriots fan again? Something like, or, this has, like, insulted me to my core so much that I cannot watch this team.
Yeah, no, I don't think I ever got to that level, but it was something that was indefensible, right? Like,
yeah.
I don't think anyone can defend that. It was just such a terrible decision he made there. Versus, like, you know, like, for example, when we talk about, like, Spygate, Deflategate, like, I can, you know,
yeah.
maybe put some defense there, justification there. But I think, like, you know, certainly a line was crossed there. Certainly some terrible things were done there. And that's just, like, yeah, that's just, like, something that you just don't even mess with. And but yeah, I don't think I necessarily associate with the team, because, like, I think that's that individual's decision, and the team also was not supporting that decision, right? Like,
mm-hmm.
I think a lot of people, you know, said, like, yeah, if this is true, this is unacceptable. And so I don't necessarily, like, immediately tie that to the team and, like, the players, for example, but I certainly tied that to Robert Kraft and his reputation.
Yeah, I think that makes a lot of sense, right? It's hard to take one person's actions and kind of impute that on the entire team. Do you think it would make a difference if Robert Kraft, because he's like shown, you know, I think more people know he's the owner of the Patriots than they would like the typical owner, but he's not really kind of like in the spotlight. But if it was, if he was more like involved, kind of like a Mark Cuban type or like a Jerry Jones, do you think that would have changed anything?
Yeah, potentially. I mean, yeah, I feel like I didn't see as much press about it or like media about it as some of these more recent scandals. And I don't know if that's a product of, Robert Kraft just not having as much of a media presence as someone like Mark Cuban, or if it's just more like, you know, the way our media has evolved over these past few years. Like every year, I feel like you said, like more and more things are public and exposed, or if he just has a really good PR team that like locks it down. So yeah, I almost feel like if they like hit it pretty well, and you know, I hadn't even thought about it in a while until you brought it up for this podcast. So yeah, I think if he was Mark Cuban level and it was like, you know, today, I would have expected more media coverage and potentially more serious repercussions. But yeah, I don't think it necessarily got as much airtime as it could have.
Yeah, no, his lawyers did a good job. I think eventually they got the charges dropped because the
the evidence was like illegally obtained.
They did a fine legal job, I would say.
Yeah, I mean it's crazy. I mean, like, you know, putting my fandom aside and like thinking about just like how people can just make that happen. I mean,
yeah.
I don't know if you've been watching this TV show called Dope Sick. Have you heard of it?
I've heard of it. Yeah, it talks about the, you know, the opioid crisis and like the Purdue family and everything. Yeah.
Yeah, it's been pretty gripping. I guess spoil the ending, right? I mean, we haven't seen the ending, but everyone knows how it ends, right? Like, the Sackler family right now is just not in jail or anything. They were just able to like pay off, you know, the right people or figure out how to legally manipulate things so that they don't have to go to jail. And that's just wild to me. Like, even, you know, on an even larger level in terms of like how long this was going on and how many lives this impacted, like it's crazy to me that they've gotten off relatively scot-free. And I mean, I'm not a legal expert. I know you and a lot of our friends at Georgetown are legal experts, so you guys, you know, probably better understand the system. But it's just wild.
It is insane. I think, you know, we have this idea that rights are something that everyone has and that they should be able to exercise, but that's not true. I think most rights that we typically think that we have are honestly like more like privileges, because you have to have the resources and you have to have the right to, like, you know, Robert Kraft, he probably has the best team of lawyers like money can buy, and they're able to like put up this defense. While if it was just, you know, maybe a run-of-the-mill public defender who has to have like 20 other people to work with, that public defender might just be like, hey, you should take the plea deal and do it.
I mean, when I was reading, have you read Bad Blood for the Theranos case? So I read Bad Blood, and like the biggest impression I had is like, wow, people with money can do like whatever they want with a strong lawyer behind them. Like the way Elizabeth Holmes, I guess allegedly, but, you know, allegedly, like, manipulated all these people and pressured all these people to do certain things just through her lawyers. Like, that made it very real to me that, like, someone with a lot of money can, like, almost get away with whatever because they have lawyers that are just so strong, so intimidating, and so smart. I think that was very eye-opening for me to, like, see how, like, money really impacts the legal system.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Just, especially Elizabeth, like, her lawyer, David Bowie, I think that's his name. He's just, like, really well-known.
Yeah.
And he's had a very, like, strong reputation. He's probably one of the best lawyers of the modern day.
Wow, so, okay.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah, his firm like handles a bunch of like high profile cases, and he's been kind of like really innovative about the way he runs his law firm.
Yeah, I guess, you know, I guess that's one way to put it, but
yeah.
Makes sense. I mean, it makes sense, yeah. Right? That's his job.
So, yeah, I think you're right. You know, it's, you know, I can only hope that perhaps one day there will be a case where some poor guy who was really actually taken advantage of by the police or something will somehow be able to cite Robert Kraft's one of the judge's opinion there as a way that they can he or she can receive justice, and that would be ironic.
Yeah, it would be, for sure.
Yeah, so I think it's interesting that it feels like the most severe thing and the most like morally corrupting that happened is perhaps something that didn't affect your fandom, but something like, you know, Spygate or Deflategate, which is arguably tied to the team and has, you know, fed this reputation of the Patriots being a dirty organization.
Right.
You're right. Did that affect your fandom at all? Or, because as you said before, you kind of like, oh, you can defend that more easily.
Right.
Is that where kind of like the tribe mentality kicks in? And you're like, oh, like, look at the evidence. Look at this. Like, oh, it doesn't even matter if the balls are deflated or not.
Yeah. I think so. I think you're right. Like, that's where maybe the tribe mentality kicks in more, where I'll say, you know, it's really just the Patriots being innovative, just like Elizabeth Holmes' lawyer.
Yeah,
in terms of the
innovative cutting edge of the football strategy.
Yeah, Spygate more, like the loose interpretation of what you could do. And then Deflategate, I guess, I mean, the key thing was there's just like no smoking gun in terms of the evidence. I mean, partially because, what, Brady destroyed his phone or something like that?
Yeah. Delete.
Oh, he did. So, yeah, something like that. But so I feel like Spygate was more like innovation and just like loose interpretation, right, of certain rules. And then my defense for Deflategate would just be that, I mean, apparently a lot of people were manipulating balls, like Aaron Rodgers too. Apparently preferred overinflated balls, and so I mean, baseball is kind of similar, right, where they're talking about being able to use these sticky substances as pitchers, and I think they've actually really come down hard on that now, but like it was a thing where a lot of people were doing it and it wasn't really enforced. So but yeah, then at the same time, then you start to think, okay, well, you take that slippery slope, how do you extend that to like performance enhancing drugs, and like, oh, everyone's doing steroids. I think like the league really should just be consistent in enforcement too. Like, you know, regardless of what you think of Deflategate, I think it's true though that the league should do a good job of being consistent with its enforcement.
Got it.
But so, yeah, maybe some tribe mentality there. Stuff, yeah, for sure.
That's what I'm getting at. Because did that affect your fandom, like, at all? Did it ever maybe drive you closer to that question, like, oh, I'm never going to be like a Patriots fan again? Or was it, it seems like it was the opposite, actually. Right? Like, I'm going to be a Patriots fan. The cutting edge of
things. Yeah, I mean, I think, yeah, I wouldn't say it drove me away in terms of fandom. I think, like, the things that would drive me away is, yeah, certainly decisions that are, like, clearly reprehensible. Like the Robert Kraft one. Although the Robert Kraft one, at least for me, I was able to mentally compartmentalize that to, like, that's Robert Kraft's wrongdoing and not necessarily like the team. But of course, you know, or I mean, like, yeah, Patriots had the Aaron Hernandez case, right? And that's like, yeah, there's no way you can support a player like that. And even his teammates had called him out, right? So the team wasn't behind that once everyone found out about it. But stuff like Deflategate and Spygate, though, yeah, I don't think it pushed me away from the team. I think, yeah, if anything, it probably just helped, you know, grow that tribe mentality.
Got it. Okay. So I'm just going to throw, now it's probably just like kind of throwing hypotheticals.
Oh, man.
What if it happened? And I get, that's because I struggle about this too. And I would probably agree with you there. It's not, if it's something like that, like I wouldn't be like, oh, like I wouldn't throw the Hawks under the bus. I would just be like, maybe not as much as like, oh, like cutting edge. I'd be like, yeah, like there's that, but I don't know, maybe the players weren't involved and I really like the
Right.
players. That's like more of a management thing. Like, I started to compartmentalize everything.
Yeah, I guess.
So, yeah. I guess what if it was more like what the Astros did, right? During, I think, the 2017, right? Does that affect you, or does it? I guess also this idea that I feel when something like that happens, and it felt like the World Series this year, it was
Right.
like that, where because the Astros did that, like everyone just wanted the Astros to
Right.
lose and they wanted the Braves to
Yeah.
win, which is
Oh
great for
yeah, by
me,
the way, I forgot to congratulate
but
you on
yeah,
the World Series win.
thank
I was
you.
really hoping the Sox
Yeah.
would pull through. But
Yeah,
unfortunately.
that would have been
Yeah.
fun. Yeah. Boston and Atlanta kind of have like a weird like semi-sports rivalry for some reason. I think it comes from like I think 2008 when the Celtics played Atlanta, like we took them to like seven games or like very Wrigley. And there was that other thing in 2017 that we're not going to talk about. But yeah, like if it's like I guess part of it is that everyone kind of like gangs up on you and you want to like hunt them
Right,
down,
right.
right? Does yeah, I think yeah, like treating where it was bad. Like they shouldn't have been doing it. I think if I remember, like, clearly against the rules, and they were like
Right.
hiding it, right? So I think all those things would get. Would that affect how you feel about the
That's a good
Patriots, like
question.
Celtics and
Yeah.
Red Sox?
I mean, yeah, something like the Astros case and like the other case that comes to my mind is like the New Orleans Saints bounty gate. I think those are the two cases that come to my mind where, not necessarily like someone murdered someone, but clearly violating the rules, like no loose interpretation justifies it, and yeah, it's just like detrimental to the game. Yeah, I wouldn't defend it for sure. I wouldn't defend it, and then I guess the second question though is how would it affect my relationship with the team? Yeah, I mean like I think it would just be a case if it was a one-off, I think how I would react is like yeah, like clearly we were in the wrong here. We can't be doing stuff like Bounty Gate. We can't be doing sign stealing in a way that's like just not allowed. And as a whole team, but I don't know if it would necessarily like push me away from the team, at least with a one-off. I think of course if there's like consistent things happening there where it's like yeah, one year it's Bounty Gate and next year it's something else, et cetera, then yeah, I think that would really hurt team fandom. Or if it's like being driven by the coach or whatever, it'd be like get this coach out of here, right? Like get whoever's responsible for this culture out of here. But yeah, I mean I've been in the privileged position where I haven't had to experience where like I've had a team that's just like always at the bottom with like and not just at the bottom in terms of like sports performance, but a lot of scandals on top of that and things like that. I think it would be tougher to be a fan.
Right, I think you hit upon something where is it at the end of the day about performance? I've kind of seen, I remember reading an article a long time ago that sports is the ultimate like meritocracy, right? Where it's about like how well you do and almost like nothing else matters in right? Because like what you're saying is it like you've never been in a position where your team is like really bad or and they're like a bad
Right, it's
organization with like
interesting you
corrupt,
put yeah, it's
immoral
interesting I'd
people.
put that qualifier in, like I wasn't consciously doing it, but yeah, I did put it in. You're right.
I mean same here,
Yeah.
right? I think the Hawks are kind of like a middling team. So that's why like I just didn't follow them. Like if they won more, if they had success when I was younger, I might have followed them and that could have like tied to it more if they were like a bad team. But okay, they were like they're a middling team, and maybe if like their owners were bad or like everyone about them was bad and they had a like a horrible history, then I just no one would care about them
Right.
anyways, right?
Yeah, I think in terms of performance, man, that's it's a good call out. I think what I look for though is just like even if you're a middling team though, like you could still be very entertaining to watch due to the heart that you have, like passion. Like I'm thinking of like the Isaiah Thomas Celtics teams, for example, and how the Celtics just overperformed with Isaiah Thomas. And that's like, that was a very entertaining team to watch because of like, I always love the underdog, and the underdog being able to like beat Goliath every now and then, like that's also really entertaining to watch. And then I think the other thing that's also entertaining to watch, but if you're not, you know, truly a contending team, it's just a team with like potential. So like team with like a lot of good young prospects that are developing, you know, we know like realistically they're not necessarily going to be the NBA champions this year, but it's like, yeah, you've got a lot of the, you know, the next big superstars of the league potentially in your team. I think that's also really fun to watch. And so it's just like, so I guess some of the other emotions there are just like hope, really. And like, if a team could still be very inspiring and great to watch, if they provide hope either through the overperformance as an underdog that just like has a lot of heart, or, you know, hope for like later seasons because you've got like these young players that are very exciting and show a lot of potential.
Yeah, so it's almost like, I feel like you're going towards it. It's really about like kind of the product that you put on the floor.
Yeah.
Right, you have to like sell like hope, you have to sell like winning. Yeah. And that's what maybe like matters the most. You know, it's kind of like, you know, if you sell one of those two things, but for like, what if you do, what if you're like a quote unquote like bad? I guess kind of the thing that comes to mind is, you know, when there was that whole thing about like Isaiah Thomas, and then his like sister passed away, and then he played, and then he was also like, he hurt his hip, but then he was like still kind of playing, and there's just kind of like rumors that Danny Ainge is not, you know, he's like a cold like operator, right? He's like ruthless, and like people like Anthony Davis's dad was like, oh, like I want my son playing for Boston because of Danny Ainge. Like, does that, I guess, offend you as a Celtics fan in the sense that Danny Ainge might be a bad person and is mean? Or does it offend you as in Danny Ainge isn't doing his job? He should be trying to, like, woo Anthony Davis over here. He should be treating, like, our star players. Or is it just, like, a mix of both? Or
I don't think it's... like either for me, at least for those specific cases that you're talking about, like the Anthony Davis case specifically, and then the Isaiah Thomas case. Like, let's start with Isaiah Thomas. I think like Isaiah Thomas playing after his sister's death, to me that sounded like it was just really what Isaiah Thomas wanted. And I think if I were in his shoes, I would probably do the same thing. It's just like, you have such a strong love of the game. You know, you had a very emotional moment, but, you know, there's just this feeling like, yeah, you want to show that you would go on, and like, you believe that, you know, your sister would want you to go on and keep going forward. I think that I would share that same mentality that Isaiah had. And to me, that was purely his decision. And it sounded like it was his decision. And then I think it was the same thing with the hip. And unfortunately it was a poor decision in the long run for Isaiah Thomas, right? It was really poor decision. But it sounded like it was very driven by him in terms of what he wanted to do. I mean, I think you can make an argument though that maybe the team should have just like told him no anyways, right? That's what Kyrie's claiming that the Warriors should have done with KD instead of, because KD said, no, that was my decision. I wanted to come back. I was willing to take that risk of tearing the Achilles. But Kyrie's like, if I was there, I would just said no. Like, even though KD wanted to come back, I would just said no. So I think that's... so I think the sister's clear cut. I think the Isaiah Thomas hip injury is tougher. I could go either way on the Isaiah Thomas injury, where like, yeah, maybe the team should be looking after the player more. But at the same time, you know, everyone's an individual, and like, we all take risks, and that's, you know, what happens with risk is like a negative consequence can happen. Otherwise it wouldn't be a risky decision at all. So I could go either way on that. And I feel like because I could go either way that I don't really blame Danny Ainge for letting Isaiah Thomas play there. And then, cause yeah, like, I mean, I don't think anyone knew that like that would have been an injury that would have had such long-term damage, right? Like, I think most of us just thought okay, yeah, he's just playing on a bad hip and he may take a little extra time to recover before next season. So I think with the knowledge we had at the time, I don't blame Danny Ainge for that. The Anthony Davis one is interesting.
Because they're kind of related, right? Because it's kind of like, oh, how Danny Ainge treated, right. allegedly treated Isaiah right. Thomas influence, yeah. right? And so, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like the Anthony Davis, his dad not wanting Anthony Davis to go there. I don't know. I'm more in the perspective that, like, yeah, the NBA is a business. I think the Lakers would trade Anthony Davis as well if Anthony Davis suddenly became a negative asset due to some injury or just due to age decline, things like that. And so I don't think the Lakers, like, I think, frankly, I think Anthony Davis's dad's a little naive in thinking that, you know, the Lakers leadership would also not trade Anthony Davis if it benefited the team. And so I don't blame Danny Ainge for having that reputation. But you brought up another interesting question, though, is do I blame him, though, for not being able to convince Anthony Davis and Anthony Davis's dad that, like, basically just, like, overcome that reputation? Do I blame Danny Ainge there? I don't. I think Anthony Davis' heart was, like, really already set out to just go to L.A. Like, LeBron does an excellent job of recruiting people, and that's just a sway that LeBron has that, like, no one else really has. Like, not even Pat Riley, not Danny Ainge, not any GM. So I think that's tough. And I think L.A. and, you know, I guess, like, being in a movie and things like that, all those perks of L.A.,
yeah.
are hard to compete with, and like that's why you have so many players going to like places like LA or Miami just because of the lifestyle there, and that's just something that's tough. And I also don't think Anthony Davis would have put us over the hump anyways. Like, mm-hmm. I think Anthony Davis is, I mean, Lakers fans are gonna hate me saying this, but I think he's a little overrated. I don't think he's like,
oh, really? Interesting.
I don't think he's a true number one, like consistent number one. Like, if LeBron was out, how far would Anthony Davis take the Lakers team? I'm not sure he would take them that far necessarily. And I mean, that's not necessarily like a total detriment, because also the Lakers just lack a lot of depth as well, as we're seeing. But to me, like, I don't think losing Anthony Davis is actually that huge of a loss. And he, I mean, we've had these debates before, but I just don't feel like the five has as much, like, the center position has as much ability to impact championship-winning teams specifically as much as, you know, these two-way wings like a Tatum, like a Kawhi, like a LeBron, or just, like, game-breaking point guards like Steph Curry.
No, I think that's right. AD, I've kind of seen, especially, I think, when they won the championship, is kind of like the ultimate, like, play finisher.
Right.
Right, he can like pick and pop, he can roll, he can, you know, he might not be like the best like offensive like creator, but if you put him in the hands of someone, you know, I mean, that sounds a little demeaning. If you give him a guy who can really like handle the ball and set him up in the best positions, then that's where he like really thrives, not necessarily as like a post up kind of a creator or offense guy. And then he just cleans up everything like defensively, like, so
he also just shot really well, like above his averages, I think, during that run, because like he's actually not that good of a three-point shooter.
And especially during like in the mid-range, he shot like so well. I think you're right, he got really hot.
which happens of course, but I'm not sure if he can really, and like, at least based off like the other playoff games we've seen him in, he hasn't necessarily been able to reproduce that.
Yeah, or at least not kind of like carry the team on, put the team on his back in kind of like the traditional sense. And I think it's probably just harder for a big man to do it these days. But getting back to that, so it's more like, I guess if Danny Ainge was like, let's say the GM, the coach, all the players were basically Kyrie Irving, but on the Celtics, but they won. Uh-huh. Like, let's just say they won, like, a lot. Uh-huh. Would you be like, I don't, I'm not a fan of this team.
Or yeah, what, so what do you mean by that? Like, you mean, like, yeah, the yeah. whole team is yeah. anti-vax, the coach is anti-vax, the GM's.
Right, just, like, everything, like, you, just everything you disagree. Well, yeah, like, right? Mm. But they won. They won, like, a ton. Let's say they won the championship, like, every year.
Oh, that's tough. I mean, it's hard for me to imagine a team like that being able to just, like, logistically win right now. But, like, yeah, I mean, putting away, you know, like, just, like, really immersing myself in this hypothetical. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, like, maybe the tribal part of my brain would be, like, you know, screw the haters. We're still winning. But, you know, the more, like, rational side of me might be, like, yeah, there's some questionable decisions being made by these people.
Does it also help that this is sports and it, like, literally doesn't
matter? Right, yeah, exactly. So I think that certainly helps as well. But yeah, that's a tough one. Yeah, I think, like, if a team, like, consistently had that, I think it would be harder to root for them. But maybe if I...
But not impossible.
Yeah, maybe if I was, like, constantly immersed around, like, Boston friends or Boston fans who were supportive, maybe, like, that would enable the tribal part of my brain to overtake the rest. But me being right now displaced on the other coast, like, I think that would be harder to stomach.
Yeah, no, I think that makes a lot of sense, right? If you're, like, surrounded by that and everything. Because I almost, sometimes I think about, so my favorite player is, like, Jeremy Lin, right? So I think about, like, oh, like, what's, like, the lowest level of crime that would be for me to stop being a fan, right? And I think I think if he beat someone up, I would need to know why he
up. For sure.
Right? And it's almost like, I think to some extent it's, like, even more extreme to, like, a sports team. Because I thought about, you know, let's say, like, I found out, like, all the Hawks were in some sort of, like, drug ring. And, like, they're also, you know, and I would be like, okay, like, what was it? Was it hot? You know, because that's, like, legal in a lot of places. Right. But I'm just like, oh, that's not the team. It's like, it's a spirit. You know, it goes beyond that. Even, but they're like, oh, it was literally the whole team. You're just like, oh, well, you know, it's like you were saying, it's more of the team is, like, an abstract concept.
Right. That's a good question, though. Like, maybe, I mean, I'm answering this in a certain way right now, but maybe I'm thinking too highly of myself, too, so we'll see.
Yeah, no, it's interesting, because I wonder, like, especially nowadays, it's, because I'm reading some stuff about, like, Kyrie, and it's like, oh, does it matter that he's anti-vax? Like, does it, like, actually matter? Is it just like one person?
Right.
He just happens to have, like, a big, like, spotlight on. Right. Like, are these people, like, role models? Kind of like the Charles Barkley thing. Like, he said famously, like, "I'm not a role model."
Right.
Like, does this like really matter? And, like, how much hold? Because in one sense, you know, kind of what I said was, like, do we think this way because it doesn't matter at the end of the day? Mm-hmm. And yet it matters so much to us. Mm-hmm. Like, emotionally speaking.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, with Kyrie, I guess, like, in a sense, like, he is this individual, he's making his individual personal decision, and he's doing this to, I mean, it's kind of, you know, contradictory, like, he's doing this to make a statement, but he hasn't actually, like, been, at least not publicly, I feel like, spreading a lot of, like, anti-vax messaging. So, you know, ultimately, there's this individual who made this decision for himself, and, like, you know, that's one thing. But he's not actively, like, spreading this messaging like, you know, Tucker Carlson is on Fox News. So, yeah, it's a little harder to judge Kyrie. I mean, you can certainly, like, if I was a Brooklyn Nets fan, though, you could certainly judge him for, you know, putting certain goals over the team's goals. But at the same time, like, if he truly believed these certain things, although, like, his logic, though, it doesn't sound like, it sounds like he's, like, you know, I'm doing this for a certain group of people, and so he's making it sound like he's not necessarily anti-vax, but But yeah, I think like if I was a Brooklyn Nets fan, like you could still judge him for doing things that are against the team and that abstract concept. A Celtics fan though, I'm happy. It's like the Nets are a little more mortal.
A little more mortal, yeah. Yeah, that's true. Although it doesn't, it doesn't seem like anyone's really kind of, it's still early.
It's still, yeah, it's still very early. And I think like we're starting to see like some teams turn it around, some teams starting to struggle again. So yeah, I think like it should be a good year. I think there's like a good amount of parity this year.
Yeah. No, it's especially this year. Like there's a ton of parity with like Kyrie being out.
Yep.
And yeah, anyone could really, like even kind of like the teams that are doing well right now, like Philly and like Miami.
Right.
Kind of like, oh well, let's see how it is. Kind of like getting into playoffs.
Yeah. Really. I mean, Miami lost last night, right? And then Philly just lost to the Raptors. It looks like, although they were playing without Embiid though. Okay, that's fair.
It'll be interesting. And so I guess, I think we really, I don't know, to me about like the fandom answer and like what really matters, it kind of like does come down to, it seems like, is the team putting on like a good product? Like, are they winning? Are they selling hope? That's what really matters. Because it also, maybe that's kind of how it should be, because to some extent I think sports is kind of like an escape from all of that.
Right, like, it's its own domain, it's its own realm.
And we go away to like not to kind of like escape all these like other things, and you know, just kind of like focus on what's there. But I guess then it makes kind of like this, the art gone, like when we talk about like Deflategate and like Spygate and then like the Astros did. Mm-hmm. Like when those things happen, it doesn't seem to turn people away from their teams. They just like hunker down more. When I'm almost like, oh, like shouldn't, to me, I'm thinking like, shouldn't that have more of a weight on it? Because you're, in some way, you are like desecrating the sanctity of the game that you would so much enjoy. But then, you know,
that's one
like,
way to look at it.
Yeah, we're on the cutting edge. Right?
Yeah.
Do you have any thoughts about like how like this, like how do we like separate, like are these bad people on this team from this is a team that I love?
I mean, I think like I feel like it's actually kind of easier for sports because like, you know, what happens is, you know, something like Aaron Hernandez happens, person gets cut, and the team moves on from that person. I feel like it's a harder thing when people are asking me about like artists, for example, or you know, like musicians or like people making music, right? And like they don't represent a team, they represent themselves. So it's like, you know, with cancel culture and stuff, like do you just stop listening to a certain artist because they did certain things? To me, that's a much harder thing to reconcile internally than like, oh, and a specific athlete on a team, because that athlete doesn't, the team represents a group of people, not just that individual, and that individual can be cut, traded, benched, whatever, and the team can still be, you know, separate from that individual. But yeah, I feel like with artists, it's harder though, because they don't represent a team, they represent themselves, and then they do something, you know, terrible, but you still like their music, like, what do you do?
What do you do? No, I think that's a really good distinction you make. Because you're right, you can like cut a team, you can cut a guy, you can not cut them too. I guess that shows that shows something on the team's part sometimes. But yeah, I think that makes a lot of sense. There's something nice about this abstract idea behind the team or like the group.
Yeah, there's like no, you know, there's no I in team, right? So, the individual's always, the team's always above the individual.
Yeah, it's kind of funny you also mentioned like Theranos and like everything earlier. It's kind of like, oh, like sometimes what happens with like companies, they'll be like, oh, it wasn't us who did it, right? It was our employees, and they acted outside of the scope of what they were doing. That's not what happened with like Elizabeth Holmes, but a little bit with the like the Purdue family,
right?
Right, they're. I think what they're trying to do is like saying like, oh, like this was through like all like our entities like doing this, and it wasn't.
Right.
You can't just if you peel back the layers of the onion, you can't like pin it on us. But it's almost like, does that, how does that end? And then teams are also kind of like, they're not, it's not just like one person.
Yeah.
Right. It's like an evolving set of people. And then it's just like easy to compartmentalize.
Well, so I think like the company example is different. Well, and it also depends on the specific case. So like there's a difference between an individual doing something terrible in their personal time versus like doing something through the team or the corporation. Like, for example, like I think like the Purdue Pharma thing, like we're not like criticizing, you know, the Sackler family for stuff that they were doing in their personal time. We were criticizing them for things they're doing through the corporation and like through their business. And then, so I think that's one piece of it. And then I think another piece of it is, you know, who's doing it. Like, yeah, like if you're the owners and the leaders and you set like the culture and the processes, that's different than having like a rogue individual or a rogue employee. But I guess like, you know, I guess the argument with like Deflategate and Spygate is that like, yeah, that was done in a way where, you know, some leader of the team was driving that. And then, I mean, the third factor, though, is just like, yeah, what is the actual negative consequences? And I think with, again, with Deflategate, Spygate, I can more easily defend that and say, like, hey, everyone was manipulating balls, and there's no, you know, strong smoking gun evidence against Brady. But, you know, I can say, like, yeah, everyone was manipulating balls. Everyone's looking for leverage in terms of, like, these rules. But if you, you know, led some, like, epidemic that has caused millions of people to die or suffer, like that's a different story, right?
So you're saying that's the bar. If like somehow the Patriots caused the opioid epidemic, then you can't.
Oh yeah, you can't defend that. Opioid epidemic, okay. You can never defend.
Got it. Okay. All right. So we're starting there. And we're gonna keep on going until we find the lowest crime that the Patriots or the Celtics could do for you to zone.
Yeah.
I mean, that's kind of the question, you know, right? Like how, you know, and this is even something this is probably might be like a whole other podcast, but
right.
Like what if like the history of the Patriots was something like, you know, like the Redskins, right? Mm. They're like named, does that affect it?
Mm.
I don't know.
Yeah. I mean, the Washington football team now. Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I haven't looked into the history of it too much. I mean, I knew it was a controversy.
Yeah.
Yeah. But yeah, maybe another podcast just for that.
Yeah. All right. Well, thank you, Kevin, for taking the time. Please, I know you started your own company recently.
That's correct.
It's very exciting.
Yeah. Thank you, Jeff. So yeah, started this company called Fairy Home, and you know, at its simplest idea, it's about making it easy for people to buy homes without an agent. For me, the idea came from trying to buy a house in SF without an agent. So I actually have a realtor mom. I've been around like the process for a while. And so I decided, hey, let me try going without an agent. And it just basically like really introduced me to this whole process and like, you know, some of the perverse incentives different players in this process have and things like that. But ultimately for me as a consumer, there's a lot of benefits for me to be able to just have total control over my process, be able to negotiate directly with the listing agent, be able to just operate on my own timeline and at my own, you know, terms, negotiation, etc. I think there's certain barriers right now that still prevent people from doing that. And so Fairy Home, our MVP, is basically a TurboTax that makes it easy for you to submit an offer without an agent. Like a lot of people today are already finding homes on their own, but they're still bringing an agent for that last bit. And that's where we're starting. But yeah, still very much early stages. We just launched a beta in New York, starting to work on California, and we'll go from there.
Sounds great. Is there anywhere we can learn more about Fairy Home?
Yeah, you could go to the website, fairyhome.com, and we're also starting a blog-newsletter to highlight people's stories around home buying. Like, one of the things that I think was always strange to me is that, like, people don't really talk about their home buying experience that much. I mean, maybe not so strange, right? Like, it is kind of a personal thing. But like after the fact, I think it's just helpful for people to learn from, you know, people we know, our peers, our coworkers, our friends, and just hear how they went about their experience. And like, be able to kind of break down some of that information asymmetry that happens when you like go out there as a first-time home buyer and basically just, you know, make it more common knowledge for everyone.
That sounds great. I'm always looking to kind of cut costs where I can. So
yeah, there's that too.
You know, yeah. Once you're all up and running in California, if I ever want to buy out here one day, then yeah, I'll definitely hit you up.
That's awesome. I appreciate that, Jeffrey.
All right. Well, thank you, Kevin. And thanks for listening.
Thanks for having me.